Whether you like it or not, and whether you know it or not, your soul is driving everything that matters to you. How much is my soul able to sustain the outpouring I'm doing in my ministry or leadership? How much of the inflow from God is really flowing out? Or am I starting to be tempted to try to give out of a vacuum instead of give out of overflow? You know better than this. You know better than this. Those were the five words that blared through my soul as I dropped to my seat, hurried, exhausted, and overwhelmed. It was seat 7D on United Flight 1181, a flight from Denver back to my home in Chicago last summer. This was the 25th flight I had taken in 13 short weeks, venturing between 8 cities scattered across the U.S., between Albany, Los Angeles, Missouri, that's a whole city, Denver, Orlando, Charlotte, Milwaukee, and even Colorado Springs. For nearly 2 years, my work had been transitioning to Boulder, Colorado. And this was the final grueling stretch before the move that was coming in 3 weeks. Between managing travel and managing my responsibilities, maintaining an apartment in Boulder, and taking our family home from the northwest suburbs of Chicago into cardboard boxes, I was unraveling. I recognized my symptoms, a visceral kind of stress. I don't know if you feel that, like somewhere between not quite my chest and not quite my stomach, but somewhere very physically I could feel that. I was beginning to numb out emotionally, losing my ability to focus, overwhelmed by some fear. You know better than this. And indeed, I did. What did I know? As the saying goes, I had learned the hard way. Through a very different set of circumstances nearly 20 years prior, I learned that my whole life emerges from an integrated, beautiful, resilient, yet fragile aspect of myself that the Bible calls the soul. I also learned that, like it or not, everything that matters to me is driven, absolutely driven, by the well-being of that soul. I had also learned that my soul integrates and enlivens all the various dimensions of my personhood. My will, my mind, my emotions, my thoughts, my physical body, even my relational context. All those things are dimensions of the soul. I had learned, therefore, that my top priority, no matter what, is to take care of my soul. Especially as a follower of Jesus, this was vitally important. I learned that I could place my soul, no matter what else is going on, solidly and intentionally, mindfully, you could say, in the ever-present care of God. How did I learn this? It was that time 20 years ago when a Boston-based team of doctors and neurologists had scratched their heads as week after week, month after month, a fierce nausea left me weak, unstable, and not improving. The mysterious malfunctioning of something deep inside my brain had altered my vision, my balance, and my focus. And we never quite knew why. Several factors conspired, but fundamentally, this I discovered. This profound loss of my physical self, my physical health, had in part happened because of my failure to care for my soul in a season of stress. And through the gracious blessing of some amazing mentors, some challenging authors, and authentic friends, that season of despair and hopelessness opened an unexpected and radically new path for me, a path of caring for my soul. It brought me personal healing in many areas and a dimension of wholeness that was entirely new. It also brought me an unanticipated but deep sense of purpose and calling, and many of you know what that's like, when something in your own life becomes something you can offer to others who are on a similar journey. But as I sat on that flight that afternoon, I could feel the fragility creeping back. Months of pushing beyond my limits emotionally, physically, spiritually were taking their toll. My body was talking and it was not happy. Unwisely, I met the demands of life between two cities, between house selling and house hunting, packing up a life and a family, and maintaining all of my workload. I met all those challenges with near disregard for my own well-being. I did know better than that. But unlike my response in my early 20s, where I just kept pushing harder and harder, my response on Flight 1181 was immediate and clear, free and hope-filled. I may have known better than that, but once I realized, once I knew what was going on, I knew the way out. I raised my interior white flag. I surrendered. Tears, I remember, this is not very often for me, but tears flowed as I reached for my journal instead of my laptop. It would require some adjustments, I knew that, but my vision was clear. It was time for some radical self-care. The next day and into the following week, I gave myself permission to do whatever my body needed, that my soul needed. Wholesome, nourishing food. Like, would you think of that as a means of soul care? It is. Sleep. Soulful conversations with my sons and with my husband and my community. Time for silence. Time for prayer. Exercise. Even reading the classics. What I'd like to do today is offer you just a bit of a glimpse of what can happen when you're finding things a bit unraveling, and how to move towards a life that God, I believe, intends for us to live, a life of simplicity, even amidst the significant demands that will likely not change. And that's the hope, that there really is a way of life, precisely in the midst of the demands and pressures that we all have, in which we can truly experience peace, joy, generosity, the ability to forgive, even love. This way of life has often been thought of as a pursuit of simplicity. But I hope you'll see by the end of our time together that raising that white flag of surrender might be the first thing you need to do, but ultimately the move towards simplicity involves recruiting a lot of decisions and ultimately requires the bold act of almost, you could think of it as rebellion. Rebellion against the way our world works. Now, a lot of modern sources, when you think about the topic of simplicity, think about how to make your life more manageable. And when things are complex, sometimes that does sound very attractive. Are you familiar with Real Simple magazine? It's a really nice publication. They have beautiful photography. And their tagline on their website, if you go there, says, making life more manageable. And I don't know, I like their photography and stuff, but they advertise $400 sweaters as the solution to it doesn't seem very simple to me. But the goal of manageability isn't necessarily what Jesus has invited us into. And I think of also, remember the advertising campaign for for Staples that had the easy button, right? Like, when things get hard, where's the easy button? And we might crave that, we might want that when things get hard, but is that really the life that Jesus is inviting us into? Manageability really is different from one person to another. We all have very different circumstances. And it can be that in the midst of those circumstances, we can experience the kind of peace that Jesus invites us into. Just in this past year, I've encountered several friends with very difficult life circumstances. Some are going to sound not so hard, and some are really hard. But the circumstances simply were not manageable. One young mom I know had 3 children under the age of 6, right? Like, who's running around like crazy there? So, 3 children under the age of 6, and we were just talking one day, and all 3 of them over the course of one weekend had the stomach flu. It just went through the whole family. Nobody slept, nobody ate. It was just a complete mess. Some of you have been there. Maybe that's your weekend now. That was her reality that weekend. Another friend I know of had to lay off in one fell swoop, hundreds of workers in a publicly held company when their profits plummeted. And that's not manageable. That tears you up inside. And in one particularly horrific, tragic situation, a friend of mine from high school and his family stood by helplessly watching his and their shared life completely dissolve as a brain tumor ate away what was left of his mind. Manageable is nowhere near that situation. But why do I mention those stories? In each case, these great human beings, and trust me, these are amazing human beings. They're ordinary, but they're amazing. They navigated these unmanageable circumstances, whether trivial or extreme, with grace and growth and dignity, sanity even, you could say beauty and even power and strength. How did they do it? It took a different approach to this vision of simplicity. When I think of simplicity, I think of it as a singularity of purpose, a focus, complete and full devotion to one thing. In my life and in the lives of those I've mentioned, the context of this life of devotion is an active pursuit and following of the person of Jesus, allowing his teaching, his example, and the daily, very real presence of his life to impact directly our own. Now, to be clear, this is an intention. This is a desire. It's a direction. It's never done, it's never achieved, and it's certainly never perfect. But I think of it as an aspiration and an important one to bear in mind. This is the kind of person I want to be. But I often wonder, and maybe you do too, why do we have to fight so hard for that? Why do we have to fight so hard for that kind of simplicity in our living? How does it slip away so quickly and so easily? Now, in part, I've come to see that there's an internal tension that all of us just have as our human nature. We sort of gravitate towards crazy, and that's a technical term. Wherever we go, we take the crazy with us. And so when we live in one place and we think this, all the circumstances around us are making us crazy, and then we move to another place and you find out that like everything changed, but you brought crazy with you, that's just part of our interior world. It's our disposition. Author C.S. Lewis, you may know of him, he noted this inclination toward busyness that is different than the circumstances around us when he said, "It is tiring and unhealthy to lose your Saturday afternoons going into the office, but to have them free because you didn't matter, that is much worse." We're terrified to think that our lives or our work or our value doesn't matter. And when we get those essence-level questions burning in our head, we bring crazy with us. But beyond this human craving that leads to overstuffed schedules, our lack of simplicity is a not-so-secret goal of modern life. There's one ultra-savvy venture capitalist company that I've learned of that does a lot of work investing in technology platforms. And on one of the TechCrunch blogs, you can read an interaction where, in an interview, this company, Sequoia Capital, one of their directors, was being interviewed, and he said this. He said he only invests in companies that let consumers indulge in one of the seven deadly sins. Think about that. He rattled them off, the interviewer said, with alarming familiarity. "You don't want to be the website that people should use," he said. "You want to be the site they can't stop using." What does it mean that venture capital ensures that the companies that are most likely to get off the ground are the ones that are also most likely to co-opt your attention and your time, appealing to your worst self, your pride, your anger, your lust, your greed, your envy, your gluttony, or your sloth? Think just for a minute about some of the websites we're on every day and how do they impact us. And we wonder why we're tired and confused, distracted and afraid, disconnected and sick. We are seldom able to live the life we actually want to live without great effort and a deep refusal to mindfully follow whatever is easiest, closest, most convenient, and offered. In the realm of video gaming alone, there's a game designer and author of a book called Reality Is Broken, and her name is Jane McGonigal. She reports that, and this is kind of long, but hang with me. She says, currently there are more than 500 million people worldwide playing video games and computer games at least an hour a day, 183 million in the U.S. alone. Now, the younger you are, the more likely, of course, you are to be a gamer. And here's, these statistics will not surprise you. 99% of boys under the age of 18 play video games regularly. Here is the surprise, 94% of girls, that was a surprise to me, are under the age of 18 also report playing video games regularly. And here, catch this, the average young person racks up 10,000 hours of gaming by the age of 21. And this was written in 2014. So those 10,000 hours by the age of 21, that's 24 hours less than they spend in the classroom for all of middle and high school if they have perfect attendance. It's a remarkable amount of time we're investing in games. 5 million gamers in the U.S., in fact, 5 million people, are investing more than 40 hours a week playing video games, the equivalent of a full-time job. Now, when I first heard these statistics, I was shocked because I'm not a gamer, right? So I'm like, well, well, how do you do that? I was shocked and kind of stunned thinking of how useless all that apparent effort seemed to be. How could people give that much of their precious and one and only life to a fantasy realm? But the vast amount of time, and this is what you must understand, the vast amount of time devoted to gaming is no accident. There is actual a ton of brain science, research that is done to understand how to keep people engaged in these games. The brain science behind it is easily understood and leaves, actually, I think, some irony when we consider who or what is being played. McGonagall asks an insightful and challenging question through her book about what could happen if we harness those same brain dynamics to solve real social problems in our day, and what if we used games or anything else to try to help motivate people to stay connected and stay involved? What if real problems, not just invented ones, were approached collaboratively by teams in the context of a community? On her website, she says that her best effort so far at trying to do that, to harness that technology for social good, has been to create a game that helps players tackle challenges like depression, anxiety, chronic pain, and even traumatic brain injury. I think that's pretty cool. But in the meantime, while people like her are still figuring out ways to bring those gaming dynamics into real societal issues, we are still openly addicted to iOS notifications, text messages, the internet, Pinterest, Instagram, Snapchat, or whatever the platform of the day is. We are hooked, and they usually literally use that term, hooked, in the research, into behavioral habit loops of greater engagement with products, games, social media platforms, real estate sites, hello, that was me this last year, and beyond. Technology and its myriad expressions provide an addiction engine that's far more available, far more accepted, and even more lucrative than narcotics. But is a technology-addicted stupor actually what is really best? Is it what we really want for ourselves and each other? Is that how the human brain and human relationships function best? Are any of us actually choosing this way of life? I've discovered there is one company that is in the game design world that is actually, it's called, they have a website called Time Well Spent. And they have a whole new vision for how to use technology, not to try to figure out how to design it so you stay more engaged in that platform, but so that it's actually helping you think through the kind of life you want to lead. Because I think one of the things we have to recognize is that against this frenetic background of companies and technology seeking to capture our attention, what hope does your precious or my precious two-year-old child, I don't have one anymore, but like in theory, what does our precious two-year-old have of getting our focus? Ask yourself, how sick or how miserable or how annoying does that child need to be to get your attention? Should it really take that much? Is she not worthy of my full attention long before that point? But in today's world, it's unlikely she will get it. And the same could be said for our spouse, our friendships, and work. Are we any better for our distracted existence? I think perhaps not. On this website, Time Well Spent, they've done some research. They put some information out there that an estimated 1 billion people begin their mornings with smartphones. There's only 6 billion of us on the planet. 1 billion begin their morning with smartphones. And here's the thing that blew my mind, because I thought, yep, me too. At least 90% of them would prefer not to. Friends, 90% of us, 100% of that amount, start our day with our smartphone. 90% really would prefer not to. What? Like, how is that even possible? But as I said, it's true of me. I'm part of that 90%. I can't seem to help myself so many times. So for now, I just want to suggest that to recover real life, you and I are going to have to summon the energy and the passion of a rebel. You may think a cardigan-wearing Midwestern mom would be an unlikely candidate for the energy and passion that I'm talking about, but I reassure you, I am. We moms, you know, we come in all shapes and sizes, all dimensions of passion and energy, and all seasons of life. And while it's fun to honor moms this weekend, and for sure, we always need your prayers and support on every day, the challenges facing all of us in this society are enormous, right? To become like an all-star business person, a home decorating specialist, a slender yoga master, an organic gourmet cook, and a vibrant, stylish woman, that's just like way too overwhelming for any one person. And if you see someone who really has nailed all those categories, I promise you, she has a staff. Which is great, like I respect that. But it's not really attainable for us ordinary folks. You know, recently I heard somebody say, I hate when I think I'm buying organic vegetables, but when I get home, I just discover they're regular donuts. That's like me. That's like me, maybe like you as well. I'm not a superwoman leaping tall buildings in a single bound. I can barely jog around my own neighborhood. But when it comes to the things I care about and know deeply, I can be plenty fierce. I didn't know anyone else had picked up on this quality about me. I thought the cardigans kind of covered it well. But one day, I vaguely overheard a conversation among my sons, talking to a few of their friends, something about their mom and the word badass. Naturally, I moved closer to try to figure out what the conversation was about, and they tried and somewhat persuaded me to convince me that this was actually a compliment. Apparently, I'm a cardigan-wearing badass mom. And so just to let you know a little bit about my sons, here's a picture of my badass sons. They're with me here this weekend. Yes, and they're here right there right now. And yes, and then, yes, they're so awesome, all right. And then with my husband, they're still trying to be a little badass, but not so bad. Oh, yes, we are having a great time. We're loving your city. But here's the thing. I really kind of like this idea. Because to live with a healthy soul, guys, this is so countercultural. To live with a healthy soul, you have got to maintain, and I have got to maintain, that edge of a rebel. If you want to live the kind of life God invites you into, and I totally understand this is a priority for you and your church. I've had the deep pleasure and the honor of spending some time with your staff over the past year and getting to know them and their heart, as they increasingly, like all of us, want to live into this way of life. And I know as a congregation, you've been exploring these issues in a series about complexity or simplexity, prayer experiences, times of silence and slowing down, and I commend that. I think that's fantastic. You will be a radiant community, a city on a hill in a world gone mad. We really, if we want to live this way, have to launch our private rebellion. We have to foster an interior simplicity of the soul that enables and empowers us to very intentionally pay attention. We learn to live very mindfully. In this attention economy, the ancient traditions of mindfulness are presenting themselves as a necessary path back to sanity and to the possibility of a life really well lived. There's one book that's helped me greatly over the years that I have come to love. It's an author named Thomas Kelly, who wrote a book called A Testament of Devotion. And in it, he has an essay called The Simplification of Life. And I'm just going to read you a bit of his book. He says, "We feel honestly the pull of many obligations and try to fulfill them all. And we are unhappy, uneasy, strained, oppressed, and fearful that we shall be shallow. For over the margins of life comes a whisper, a faint call, a premonition of richer living, which we know we are passing by. Strained by the very mad pace of our daily outer burdens, we are further strained by an inward unease, because we have hints that there is a way of life vastly richer and deeper than all this hurried existence, a life of unhurried serenity, peace, and power. He says each one of us can live such a life of integration and confidence and simplified multiplicity on one condition. That is, if we really want to. That is the biggest question for us. Do we really want to? And before I move on, I just want to say that was written in the 1940s. How much more true is this today? One of the things that stands as a threat to our ability to live into this vision of simplicity is deeper than our digital distractions, deeper than a frantic pace, but it really is at the heart of conflicting priorities. And it has to do this with this question of essence, of who am I? Who am I meant to be? Who do I mean to become in this world? What does it mean to be a good person, and how do I become that? That true self kind of question is some of the most important work we do in the rebellious work of simplicity. This world, demanding world, will give you all kinds of definitions of who you are. But who has God made you to be, and what does it mean to live into that vision? The biggest enemy I've learned of simplicity in my life and in all our lives isn't the complexity. We keep blaming the complexity. It's not that. The biggest enemy of simplicity in our lives is actually duplicity. Not the epic fail of duplicity where you're living a double life or cheating on all your taxes. Those are extreme cases. But daily duplicity sneaks in all around us. When I interact with myself and with others as though I have more time, capacity, money, talent, or anything else other than what's true, I am tempted towards this daily version of duplicity. And one duplicitous decision after another can lead to personal, professional, and even interpersonal harm. When we live from a false version of self, when I live from a false version of myself, I commit to too much, I abandon self-care, and I forego the stillness and silence from which that abundant life rooted in connection with God and others can emerge. For weeks prior to Flight 1181 from Denver, I had been cutting these corners, letting the intensity of my rebellion slide, giving in to activities that were easy and comfortable and swift, rather than intentional and uncomfortable but freeing and slow. So here's a trustworthy path for recovering the beauty and power of simplicity in the midst of ordinary life. And if you want to flip over on your notes, there's 5 steps that we're going to walk through briefly as we wrap up. The first, and this gets back to this earlier point that Thomas Kelly mentions, the first is that you must decide. Decide that you want it. You cannot skip this step and think like, oh, of course, everybody wants a simpler life, blah, blah, blah. No, you need to really think about it. You have to choose. Make sure you know what you really want. Your life will always move in the direction of what you really want. And if you're not getting what your head is telling you you want in life, it would be very good to take a careful look inside and say, what is it? What are those deep desires that are driving? I hope, especially after today, that you'll choose that you want to live the kind of life of simplicity. Second thing you may need to do is you may need to surrender. You, like me, may need to throw a white flag, come to a screeching halt, or power down like you do with your computer, right? Where you shut that thing down. Have you ever had a computer that just won't stop running? Sometimes we're that way. You just gotta power it down. It might be that all you have is a half hour to just stop the madness and get time. It might be that you could swing a half day or even a whole day, as much as you can, and probably the more you need it, the more time you need to take. It may seem impossible. I remember when my kids were young, I felt like I needed an act of Congress to get like 2 hours of solitude. But figure it out. Figure out how to get that time that you need. Everything is at stake. Third thing, get quiet. I know this is really hard for us in our modern world, but for me, taking time for silent prayer has been an enormous path for healing. Depicted in Psalm 131, verse 2, and I think that's the verse that's in your notes, silent prayer is just a wordless way of resting in the presence of God with an attitude of openness and contrition and longing. And this is interesting that the brain research that's going on today is coming forward and reintroducing that actual healing takes place in our minds, in our brains. Like new neural pathways are formed when we stop the constant focus on the future or the past and learn to be silent in the present. Powerful stuff. This was introduced again as ancient wisdom that's preserved in the Bible. And here's just a couple verses that speak to this. Psalm 40 says, "Be still and know that I am God." Psalm 131 again says, "I have stilled and quieted my soul." Isaiah 26, "God will keep in perfect peace those whose minds are steadfast because they trust in him." This battle for the mind, what will your mind be consumed with? The Apostle Paul challenged us, "Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things." That's taking every thought captive, because does your mind naturally go towards that list? Probably not. Mine doesn't either, always. How do I intentionally do that? The promise that Paul gives us, that the Holy Spirit gives us through Paul, the God of peace will be with you. We have to be intentional about where we put our minds. So first decide, surrender, then we get quiet. Now the next one, you've got to get real. We are all so prone to self-deception, and it's going to take a bit of effort to see the truth. This is a vitally important step as we become brave enough to abandon our dabbling in duplicity. Be honest with yourself about what's real. For me, this happens both in prayer and often in the pages of a journal. I have a friend, he's a really amazing businessman, just a godly leader, family guy, he's got a bunch of kids. He says that he starts every day with the prayer, "God, help me see what is real. Help me see what is real. Help me see what's real in my company, in my family, in our community. Help me see what is real." I love that prayer. I think that's a great prayer. For you, that might be where you start in your journey towards simplicity. Also, we have to get to accept whatever it is we find is real. That's a really important thing, to posture ourselves towards acceptance of what's real. We might need to change, we might want to do other things, but there has to be a step of saying, "This is my reality." For me, there was one of my neurologists in the hospital, came in, this was 20 years ago, I was so sick in the hospital, my husband and the neurologist were considering what paths we would take, and I was just weeping constantly, very, very upset. And he came back, he didn't have the best bedside manner for a doctor, but he said, "Mindy, I just need you to know that you have two choices right now. You can either accept this and make the best of it, or you can make yourself and everyone around you miserable." And he walked out of the room. I've never forgotten those words. We always have that choice. I can either accept what's going on and make the best of it, or I can make myself and everyone around me miserable. And I've done both at times. But that's part of getting real, is accepting what is. All right, the fifth one, and this as well, so, so important, friends. You have to reach out. You have to reach out to your community, to others, to people for whom you can create bonds and relationships that are safe and trusting. Again, there is a whole new realm of brain science research that is discovering that people simply cannot heal their minds, their trauma, grief, addictions cannot happen unless they are in the context of safe and attached relationships. Vitally important. It turns out we can only grow in the context of relationships. And yet so many of us live in isolation. So it may be for you reaching out is a new step. But if you really want to recover your life, you have to bring someone else into your journey towards simplicity. Find a simplicity buddy to join you in the journey. So what can be the overall benefit of this journey? Maybe you're a little afraid if it sounds like a little hard. It is. But the benefit, you get to live a great life. And it might seem a little badass even, but that's okay. You get to have a deliberate, generative, overflowing life. I believe with everything in me that this is what God desires for us. It's what we were made for. Jesus' example, his teaching, his way of life, and most importantly, his resurrection power opens up a whole new kind of life for those who would follow in his way. And as he challenged his first disciples, and I think this challenge reverberates through the centuries to us today, what good will it be for someone to gain the whole world and yet forfeit their soul? A famous rhetorical question. What good will it be for you, Ace Lake, to gain anything at all in this world and yet forfeit your one and only life, your actual self? So how will you answer his question? You can start today, right now, even as you're listening. You can silently offer a simple prayer, God, help me find life. Then watch very carefully and see what happens next.